We are convening for our second case this morning, 21-IP-17-CCR. It is State versus Eric J. DeBrow. Could I please have your appearances? Good morning. All right. The lineup is 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes in rebuttal. Please proceed. Oh, I should also advise that Justice Kurowski is appearing by phone.
Thank you. May it please the Court, good morning. This case has a number of different facets that I think could yield some interesting discussion, but I want to begin with the core point in this case and try to make very clear what the state's argument is for why this court should reverse the Court of Appeals. It sometimes happens in trials. A witness in this case gave testimony that very briefly referred to a matter that had been previously excluded during the pretrial process. The defense asked for a mistrial, and the circuit court denied that request, concluding that a less extreme alternative was available. The court offered the defense the opportunity to have additional instruction given on the topic, but the defense declined that opportunity, insisting that no jury instruction would be enough to cure the taint caused by the testimony. The circuit court disagreed, and trial moved forward. Now, DeBrow's position that Isaac's testimony could not be cured through instruction and instead required a mistrial is a perfectly valid argument for him to make. But because he never objected to the content of that curative instruction, rather than the fact that the instruction was given at all, he cannot now obtain relief on the theory that the instruction itself was inadequate. Instead, he is tied to his argument that Isaac's fleeting reference to CCAP could not be cured. We entrust such assessments to the circuit courts for good reason. Here, the circuit court concluded that the issue could be cured by instructing the jury. That conclusion, is an exercise of discretion and is entitled to great deference. Otherwise, any reference to a defendant's criminal history, or to CCAP for that matter, no matter how obtuse or vague, would require a mistrial, and the law simply does not require that. So with that sort of premise in mind, I want to turn to the standard of review, which again, as I say, these decisions are committed to the sound discretion of the circuit court. That comes from State versus Ford. State versus Bunch talks about the great deference given to these decisions, and there's good reason for this. As discussed in State versus Ross, the United States versus Clark, the trial court is in the best position to determine the seriousness of an incident such as this and to make determinations about what steps are necessary to cure that or whether a mistrial itself is necessary. I do want to touch briefly on Mr. DeBrow's argument that the suggestion that prosecutorial overreach somehow warrants a different standard of review and that the decision should be reviewed under some sort of strict scrutiny standard instead. And I don't think that's what the case law says. This seems to come from State versus Bunch and State versus Bartels. And those were both double jeopardy cases. In those cases, we had a situation where there was an accusation of prosecutorial overreach, and therefore the mistrial put at issue whether the state could retry the defendant on the same offense. And so in situations where the mistrial is granted due to prosecutorial overreach, or in situations where a mistrial is granted over the objection of the defendant, reviewing courts look at that decision with a closer eye because it does implicate the defendant's right against double jeopardy. But those cases don't talk at all about decisions where a mistrial or a request for a mistrial was denied. And I think there's some practicality in that. I think one thing that you look at is that the prosecutorial overreach determination is going to be fact-dependent. It's going to require generally a circuit court, usually before retrial, to determine whether the prosecutor did in fact overreach, whether the purpose of the prosecutor's actions was to draw out a mistrial or cause a mistrial. And without that factual basis in the record, a reviewing court's not going to be able to say that this was based on prosecutorial overreach or not. The last thing I would say about that, barring any questions, is that in this case, I think it actually sort of works against Mr. DeBrow to argue that that there should be a more searching scrutiny of the circuit court's decision, because those cases talk about this scrutiny in terms of making sure that unnecessary mistrials are not granted. So to the extent that there is a difference between a manifest necessity standard in a double jeopardy case and a situation where the mistrial is granted at the defendant's request, I think these strict scrutiny cases are actually looking for a higher standard for a mistrial to have been declared. And so I'm not sure that actually works in Mr. DeBrow's favor. Now I want to talk about the kind of a component of the state's core argument, which is this idea that the mistrial decision and the jury instruction decision are two separate issues. And the way I've sort of been visualizing this as I prepared for this argument and reread through all of the things is that the mistrial decision is quite narrow. That is, the reviewing court is going to look for whether the circuit court correctly determined that there was a less extreme alternative available. Because kind of regardless of the standard of review, the case law still says that the court should only grant a mistrial if there's no less extreme alternatives available. And so once the court has made that decision that there is a less extreme alternative available, that is the exercise of discretion that we review for whether it was an erroneous exercise or a sound exercise of discretion, and it ends there. The problem with Mr. DeBrow's position and the Court of Appeals position on this point is that it's sort of forward-looking. The Court of Appeals talks about how the instruction that was actually given in the moment, there was, you know, kind of a mess in the transcript in this exact moment here. The instruction that was given did not suffice, but it ignored the fact that the circuit court also offered additional instruction to the defense. And so by virtue of offering that additional instruction, without knowing yet whether the defense is going to accept or reject that, what strategic decision the defense will make about that, the court has properly exercised its discretion. But if the reviewing court was to require that outcome and essentially require the court to go through and give an instruction or not to defer that choice to the defendant, then we get into a situation where effectively the defendant is getting the keys to the car on whether a mistrial should be granted or not, because the defense could always just say, I don't want the curative instruction, I want the mistrial. And that puts the court in the situation of saying, well, I can't cure it, or I can, you know, give an instruction over the defense request, which I think creates its own possible issues there. But that's why the exercise of discretion really has to depend on the options available to the court and the options offered to the defense, rather than how it actually ends up panning out. I think Givens is a good example of this. In Givens, there was I think it was a discovery violation, realistically, and the defense was offered a continuance to review some of the materials. It turned that down, and the court effectively said the circuit court reasonably concluded that there was corrective action that could be taken. That's good enough. It doesn't matter that the defense didn't end up accepting that offer of a continuance. The offer itself was enough to get there.
So is this just error correction?
What
would you want us to say other than the Court of Appeals got it wrong?
Sure. I don't think it's just error correction, because I do think there is some clarity needed in how this analysis particularly happens. I think Mr. DeBrow, and this court has sort of taken up the Court of Appeals position, which is that because part of the circuit court's decision was based on the instruction that it gave, that it necessarily put that instruction at issue. And I think if you look at the Court of Appeals briefing, the issue presented was very narrow. It was whether the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion in denying the request for a mistrial. And so that, because it's a separate question from was the curative instruction effective, was it an appropriate or proper curative instruction, I think that's a separate question. I think that is a question that the Court of Appeals should not have reached because it was not objected to. And we have some case law talking about the Court of Appeals' power to reach unobjected to jury instructions. And I think there's good reason for that, even aside from the power question, because, of course, this court would have the power to reach the jury instruction question. But I don't think it's necessary to, and I don't think it's appropriate to, because that was forfeited by not raising an objection to or a complaint about the content of the jury instruction itself at trial.
And that's because the circuit court could have corrected it if it had been raised at that point.
That's exactly right. And then there's also, I think it's State versus Saunders talks about wanting to prevent sort of gamesmanship and the defense baking an error. And I'm not, to be clear, I'm not suggesting that that's what occurred in this case, but it does run that risk that the defense could identify, hey, there was a problem with that instruction. It wasn't very good. So we can go through and see how this trial plays out and have something to reverse on later. And we want to avoid that. And I think the facts of this case provide a particularly stark example of that because Mr. DeBrow did get acquitted on one of the counts. So the state can't pursue that again. And now, if Mr. DeBrow has his way, he'll get a second trial where he just has to focus on the one count. And, so he sort of gets the second kick of the cat, so to speak, and the benefit of that, which is something that the case law, I think, really does not want to have happen. So I do want to talk a little bit. I mean, I don't want to get too much because, as I said, I don't think it actually matters to the analysis here. I do want to talk a little bit about the prosecutor's line of questioning that led to all of this. There was a suggestion that it was prosecutorial overreach, and I just want to make sure that, because this was kind of convoluted in the record, and it took me a little bit to sort it out. So Isaac gets up and offers his direct testimony. He's subject to cross-examination. The testimony in question occurred during redirect. And the prior to redirect, or at the very beginning of redirect, the prosecutor asked for a sidebar and essentially asked for permission to ask some leading questions. And the questions that he wanted to ask had to do with raising, and this is the part that's kind of convoluted in the record, but I do think it's there, raising these other acts. So there were incidents that were charged against Mr. DeBrow, and then there were incidents that were introduced as other acts evidence but were not charged. And so the line of questioning, it was focused on, it was about 5 in the morning, and why was Isaac awake and staring at the door, and why did he end up deciding to call the police even though he hadn't heard anything? What was causing all of that concern? The prosecutor was concerned that the defense was setting up an argument. Isaac just didn't like the defendant, and he was making all of this up, trying to get him in trouble because he didn't like it. And so the state, I think, properly was trying to answer that accusation. And to do that, the state wanted to point out that Isaac had been told by his mother about these incidents that were the other acts. So the state was never intending to get into the previously excluded prior conviction. And the state was specifically taking steps to try to keep that from happening. And so because the record just wasn't entirely clear about that, I just wanted to offer, Justice Dale, you look.
Do you think that maybe this whole thing could have avoided if that hadn't have been done? I mean, I get that this isn't central to what we decide on this case, but it seems to me that trying to anticipate some kind of argument that hasn't been made yet is very different than actually responding to one, and perhaps the door was open to things it didn't need to be open to because people were just jumping the gun.
I think you're right that ultimately it doesn't really matter to the outcome of this case. I think these tend to be the kind of fact patterns that we get in the cases that come up here just because they sort of end up yielding these situations. I've talked to prosecutors and they say that they could never get up here and answer questions from a panel. I'm not sure that I could ever go and actually run a trial. I mean, the idea of having to think on your feet and do all of that kind of stuff, it's a different skill set, and so I try to be very forgiving when it comes to, what were you thinking? Why did you get into that?
I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just saying it could be a cautionary tale.
Sure. I think, you know, we do try to admonish prosecutors to make sure that they're not, you know, fighting losing battles and creating error, but I do think ultimately there was some back and forth about kind of the proper scope of redirect examination. I do think this was, you know, kind of fell within proper scope, and I don't think that there's been a challenge to the scope of redirect examination, so I don't think that would be directly on review here. And then, you know, in terms of trying to ask the leading questions, again, I mean, I think this does show an effort to try to avoid the issues that did come up, and so could it have gone better? Yeah, but then probably there's a number of cases where it did go better and we're not here, you know? So we just don't know about those cases. They don't come up for us. So kind of hopping back a little bit to the mistrial being a separate question from the jury instruction issue, I think another point that I wanted to discuss on that a little bit is this idea of the remedy. I think the available remedies kind of highlight why the efficacy, if you will, or the adequacy of a jury instruction is, in fact, a separate question from whether the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion in refusing to declare a mistrial. And so there's this harmless error question that comes up. It's not part of the record, but I will tell you that, you know, I thought at length about whether harmless error was available even in the Court of Appeals. And ultimately, I think a harmless error argument in a mistrial case would put the state in a position of having to argue that but for the error, so even if the circuit court had declared a mistrial, the jury still would have convicted the defendant. And then I picture myself up here trying to pitch that to you, and it didn't go well. So I don't think that is actually, I don't think that that's how you get there. So I think that the mistrial analysis is very narrow on that because harmless error is not available as a remedy there. But if you are looking at the problem is the instruction that was given, well, we know that jury instructions are subject to harmless error analysis. And so I did sort of unpack it a little bit in the brief because, as I said, I think the Court of Appeals raised an issue that wasn't really before it by getting to the content of the jury instruction. And I think that because this court would have the power to reach that, if this court does reach that, I do think that there is a harmless error argument there. I mean, I think, you know, I kind of go through the facts in my brief, but I think one of the big ones is that there was this acquittal on one of the counts. And if the argument is that, hey, this was so so prejudicial that the jury was going to convict no matter what, I think the facts don't bear that out because there was an acquittal on one of the counts. As well as the significant evidence corroborated by multiple witnesses that Mr. DeBrow did, in fact, commit the assault in question here. The briefing, Mr. DeBrow's brief, did talk about the Court of Appeals decision and did sort of suggest that the Court of Appeals decision did conclude that this could not be cured, that this was not amenable to a curative instruction. I don't read the Court of Appeals decision that way. When I was reviewing the Court of Appeals decision when it first came out, the first thing to jump out to me was reversed and remanded. The second thing was this discussion, again, of harmless error. And it came back to me about, you know, why would the Court of Appeals raise the harmless error question when it's not available in the mistrial? And why would the Court of Appeals talk about the content of the instruction if its premise was that it couldn't be cured by instruction? All of the discussion about, you know, Gary M.B. and Williams and Penegar and all those cases seemed to really suggest that the Court of Appeals' position was, hey, this could have been fixed, but it wasn't. And that, again, I don't think was at issue in the Court of Appeals, and I don't think it should be at issue here. I think the only question that was properly preserved for appeal is whether this fleeting testimony, this fleeting reference to CCAP, was so prejudicial that it could not be cured. And I think the answer to that is no. I think, you know, this is kind of an interesting situation because you know, there is this suggestion that, well, the CCAP reference was a reference to something that we happen to know actually happened. But that wouldn't actually matter because the jury wouldn't know that. So this would essentially create a regime where any reference to CCAP is going to require the jury to assume the worst, that the defendant was previously convicted of doing the exact same thing or to the exact same person or anything like that. And so we know that even references to prior criminal acts, even if they're determined previously to be unduly prejudicial, that those can be cured by instruction. And so I disagree with Mr. DeBrow's argument that this could not be cured, was not amenable to a cure by instruction of the jury. Moreover, I think the briefing kind of really hammers on the state for the state's concession in the circuit court that this shouldn't come in, that Mr. DeBrow's prior conviction shouldn't come in because it's unduly prejudicial. The state has never argued that. I think a previous conviction of first-degree sexual assault of a child is going to be very prejudicial in a child sex assault case. But what I would say is that there's two points, I would say. Number one, the state never agreed that any fleeting reference to the prior conviction would be so unduly prejudicial that it would not be amenable to a cure. And number two, I think that there is some daylight between a sort of obtuse, obscure reference to CCAP and the reference to the actual prior conviction itself. So with that, I guess I'd kind of circle back then to the standard of review. The circuit court is the eyes and ears on the ground. It sort of sees all this testimony come out, and as you can tell from looking at the transcript, I don't think the transcript quite got everything. And so this is one of the situations where you kind of really want to trust the circuit court, its understanding of what happened, its understanding of whether something could be cured, whether the effect on the jury was this sort of irreparable taint or not. And so for those reasons, the state would ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals. If there's no further questions at the moment.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The issue here is simple, and it's only one issue. When the circuit court denied the motion for a mistrial, did it do so on the basis of reasonable conclusions after considering all the relevant facts and law? That is the erroneous exercise of discretion standard. The circuit court here did not, and the answer requires only a straightforward application of well-established law to the facts of this specific case. The issue is not, and never has been, whether a different instruction should have been given to the jury. The state attempts to muddy the waters by claiming that the Court of Appeals should have just ignored that spontaneous jury instruction that the circuit court gave in the midst of all the commotion surrounding Isaac's prejudicial testimony. But we cannot ignore it. It happened, and it is an essential fact that the circuit court considered, the Court of Appeals considered, and this court should consider too. A reviewing court will reverse the denial of a mistrial on a clear showing of an erroneous exercise of discretion. Accordingly, the Court of Appeals reviewed the discretion of each of the trial court's conclusions for why it denied Mr. DeBrow's motion for a mistrial. Those first two conclusions are about the prejudicial impact of Isaac's testimony. The trial court downplayed the prejudicial impact of the testimony because it did not know whether the jurors knew about CCAP, and it did not know whether the jurors would make harmful inferences about what Isaac saw on CCAP. But not knowing the extent of such harm does not erase that harm. It only takes a single juror to understand what Isaac said for his testimony to be harmful enough to warrant a mistrial. The last two conclusions that the circuit came to were about the contemporaneous instruction, that spontaneous instruction. The circuit court claimed that this instruction adequately cured the error and distracted the jury. But the law on curative instructions tells us, again, that these conclusions are also unreasonable.
What about the argument that the state is making that the defense forfeited any claim about the content of that instruction?
The reason why a reviewing court should review the content of that instruction is because the circuit court concluded that that instruction was sufficient to cure the error when it denied the motion for a mistrial. And so the erroneous exercise of discretion standard asks a reviewing court to review those conclusions. Are they reasonable? Are they based on all the relevant facts and law? And curative instruction law is relevant here because it tells us that that conclusion was unreasonable. An instruction is only curative when it is direct, clear, and unequivocal. But the instruction given here was not any of those things. Instead of an unequivocal direction, the instruction left the jury without clear guidance, and the jurors were no doubt left to wonder the meaning of that strange directive and how it might, if at all, affect the information they could or could not properly consider.
So what instruction would have been direct, clear, and unequivocal?
I don't think that the defense needs to offer an alternative instruction to be able to analyze that this instruction wasn't direct or clear.
Fair enough. But do you think there is any group of facts under which an instruction could be crafted that would be direct, clear, and unequivocal?
I think there is a large body of case law that demonstrates direct, clear, and unequivocal curative instructions that can be given, even in relationship to a character evidence, propensity evidence, pretrial violation, but that's not what happened here. Without consulting the parties, and just spontaneously, in the midst of all the commotion, the circuit court turned to the jury and stated a very unclear instruction that the jury didn't know what to do with, and then they were sent home. And then the circuit court concluded in ruling against Mr. DeBrow that that instruction was enough, but that was unreasonable, and the denying the motion of a mistrial on that basis is therefore erroneous.
Okay, but going back to in the heat of the moment, this is going on. I mean, I was a circuit court judge for 10 years. You're doing your best to just deal with what's coming at you. The judge does that and then offers to the defense, if I didn't do it well enough, tell me what else you want me to say. And the answer is there's nothing you could say that would cure the problem. And so what's the court supposed to do at that point? They're supposed to get it perfect every time they're in the midst of everything?
No, of course not. That's not the argument here. And unfortunately, it's just the way that it happened in this case. And I do think that the entire purpose of a motion for a mistrial is to say that a mistrial is warranted here because the other alternatives are not. They are not enough to cure. And so
part of the problem with that logic, though, would mean that on many, many occasions, I bet Justice Gallant, maybe other judges who were circuit court judges, and certainly me, people move for a mistrial, and often the remedy is not to grant the mistrial, but to provide a curative instruction. So what about this situation meant that there's no group of facts under which a curative instruction could have been given? And if there is one that could have been given, isn't it the defense lawyer's job to object and ask for what they need to make it right?
So the objection was that no curative instruction would have cured the error, and that's because the testimony was prejudicial enough to warrant it, and this is why. So based on just a simple reading of the testimony, just that small portion of the record, the reasonable conclusion is that Isaac learned information from CCAP that was about the defendant, Mr. DeBrow. But then when you add in the context of the prosecutor's question, the connection the state was attempting to draw between Isaac's knowledge and his reason for being, quote, on alert, watching his sister's door after he heard his sister scream, the charges against Mr. DeBrow, the testimony to that point at the trial, all of these are relevant factors. All of these give context to Isaac's testimony and allow us to understand where a juror sees and hears and understands what's going on. And just as the Court of Appeals stated, by far the most reasonable inference is that Isaac learned information from CCAP that concerned Mr. DeBrow related to sexual misconduct involving a child.
Why would they have that? He didn't say anything about sexual misconduct. First of all, they'd have to know what CCAP was, but even if they did, there are a lot of things that are on CCAP. A lot of things. And he didn't say anything at all about sexual misconduct with the child or anyone else.
Sure. So the circuit court didn't make any factual findings.
No, I'm talking about the witness, Isaac. He didn't say anything at all about those things.
He said, it's things that I looked on CCAP in response to the state's question about why he was on alert that evening.
Right.
And the context of that question, as the state very forthright was about in that pretrial hearing, was the basis of Isaac's knowledge, the basis of his concern and alertness that evening, was that he was aware of a prior conviction.
No, that's not what he said. He said, I looked on CCAP, period. That's all he said.
Right, but the context around his statement is important. We can't consider his statement in isolation from anything else. And
well, you have to consider it when you're looking at whether a mistrial should have been granted. You have to look at all the other testimony, too. And this testimony was minuscule. I mean, there was another time he was in her bedroom. There was a family rule. The boys were not supposed to go into the girl's bedroom, and that included Mr. DeBrow. He was in there, and she woke up, and he was in there the first time, and he said, oh, it's just a game. You don't have to tell your mom. She didn't tell. The second time he was in there, he woke her up by what he was doing to her, and so, therefore, she did tell her mom. That was in the record. Then there also was the pornographic video of a sexual relationship between the stepfather and the stepdaughter. And there was that was all part of this record. So you look at the testimony in light of what was going on in regard to the entire record on whether or not the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion in denying the mistrial, right? So you don't just focus on one piece of evidence. You put it in the context of all of the evidence that was presented at trial, correct?
Correct. And the context of the trial, especially if we're looking at analyzing the circuit court's discretion and what facts it had at hand in that moment when it was denying the motion for a mistrial, what facts it considered, those are the facts that allowed the circuit court to determine how prejudicial Isaac's testimony was. And so those are the facts that we have here that give us light to how prejudicial that testimony is. And those facts included some of the things that you mentioned, Justice Rogenczak, about the fact that the entire context of the case was about sexual misconduct with a child. The jury knew that. They were instructed on that. They heard testimony about that. And the state's direct testimony and their cross-examination testimony was about drawing this connection between what Isaac knew and his alertness. And that alertness is key here because the basis for his concern is what the state was trying to say was reasonable here. And so the reasonableness of his concern about his sister, based on all the testimony his sister had testified to already, based on the testimony he had testified to already, was about concern that the defendant, Mr. DeBrow, was going to be involved with sexual misconduct with his sister.
No, the concern also was his mother's rule. His mother, too, said the boys are not to be in the girl's bedroom, right? And the girls were not to be in the boys' bedroom either. That was a family rule. So why isn't his alertness part of his concern that his mother's rules be followed?
So Isaac's testimony about the, specifically that morning had to do with hearing his sister scream after seeing Mr. DeBrow enter his sister's room and then immediately leave after that scream. And up until that point, Isaac had not yet testified about anything about his mother's rules regarding who can and cannot be in whose bedrooms. The defense was on cross-examination was able to get Isaac to explain his alertness, which was, I heard a scream. But the state came back on redirect and had this sidebar with the circuit court specifically about wanting to further explain why he was alert. And again, the record is clear that the state's intent here, the state's idea, is that Isaac's alertness and his concern is because he was aware of this prior conviction. That's not disputed by the record. The entire pretrial hearing was about that back and forth. So
the only thing that was said at trial is I looked at CCAP. That's all. Nothing else about any other conviction, or certainly not about a conviction for sexual assault, and certainly not a conviction for child sexual assault. None of that's in the record. He didn't say that.
The Court of Appeals, as it meticulously laid out, the connections that a juror could very easily make to get to that inference, and again, only one juror has to be able to make that inference in order for the jury to be tainted, and it was a reasonable inference to be made. And
Why was it reasonable?
It was reasonable based on the context of that statement in the moment and the connection the state was attempting to draw between Isaac's knowledge and his alertness. And the reference to CCAP is not this obscure, fleeting moment. It was not in a vacuum. CCAP is a public record, well-known website that contains criminal convictions on it.
You also have a conviction for OWI. You find that on CCAP all the time.
Sure, or divorce or parking tickets or whatever else, but that wouldn't fit the context of the case. That would be an the circuit court had said, mentioned those kinds of things, and the Court of Appeals, as it meticulously laid out there in several paragraphs,
basically that the statement about CCAP prejudiced the jury against this defendant. And I get the argument, but that same jury acquitted him of sexual assault of the other child who was part of the same proceeding, right?
Isaac's testimony was very narrow and focused on the first witness's testimony, the older sister's testimony, for which he was convicted of.
It's the same jury and the same defendant, correct? Once he gets convicted, once the jury acquits him.
Correct, and there's many reasons for why a jury would acquit on evidence of sexual assault involving a child, and I think that's demonstrated in the record where the second witnesses, the younger sister's testimony was just less reliable. It didn't have Isaac, for example, to corroborate parts of the story that the older sister had Isaac for. Even the mother's testimony contradicted.
Was that he heard her scream, and after she screamed, he saw the defendant leave her room.
Correct. So, again, it's the context that makes Isaac's statement extremely prejudicial, and the court did try to, strike, so to speak, this testimony in this attempt to cure the error, because the circuit court did recognize that there was this violation here. This pretrial ruling had excluded this evidence specifically after the state had conceded that evidence was unfairly prejudicial. So there was this violation. The circuit court recognized that violation. It held, only that it didn't know the extent of the harm. That's what it found. It just didn't know whether jurors would know what CCAP was or what inferences they could make. But that's not reasonable conclusions to come to when deciding how prejudicial this testimony was. And then it leads, to those second two conclusions about that instruction, which was, I don't know how prejudicial this is, but my instruction cured it anyway. And that was unreasonable, not just because we know that curative instruction law makes instructions curative only in specific scenarios, but because the evidence was actually prejudicial.
So the evidence in your mind, the jury concluded from the words, I looked at CCAP, that there was a prior sexual assault conviction.
So I think that's a reasonable inference that a juror could make.
And so the jury was prejudiced because they heard that and they wrongfully convicted him.
So a fair trial requires both parties to abide by pretrial rulings of the circuit court, especially when...
But unfortunately, things happen at trial, and they're not all mistrials. So curative instructions come up, and they need to be used. So unusual things happen. Witnesses say things that you don't expect. Things happen at trial. But the I looked at CCAP is the equivalent of he has a prior conviction for sexual assault.
So again, it's Isaac's quote, it's things that I looked on CCAP in response to the state's question about why he was on alert that evening. And CCAP is a reference to the prior conviction. We know that.
How do you get there that was used with respect to one count to convict him, other count to acquit him?
I don't think the fact that he was acquitted on the second sister's allegations leans any information as to whether or not the jury reasonably inferred from that statement that there was a sexual misconduct involving a child in Mr. DeBrow's history.
But it's highly prejudicial, incurable. It's an incurable problem as to his character. Is that propensity?
Prior convictions are propensity character evidence, correct.
So the character propensity evidence worked with respect to one count but not the other.
Well, and I think, you know, the context, again, of Isaac's testimony allows us to understand that better because Isaac's testimony was there to corroborate the older sister's testimony. She had just testified in detail. And again, the context of that was sexual misconduct involving a child. And then on redirect, the state asked Isaac why he was so on alert that evening, or excuse me, that morning, early morning. And Isaac attempted to explain that with, it's things that I looked on CCAP. That is what the jury heard. The circuit court knew that. But
wait a second. That is what the jury heard. How do we even know they heard it when this court reporter didn't capture it? And I get that they both admitted that they heard it. The court heard it and the defense counsel heard it. But things are happening all the time at trial where people are talking over each other and different, and this happened very quickly. How do we even know they heard it?
Well, the court did find that the jury heard that factually, and then it found that anything that happened afterwards, after the word CCAP, the jury probably didn't hear. That's what the court found. And again, after Isaac says this, everyone jumps on Isaac. People are interrupting each other. The defense objects, and the state and the court go on Isaac about what is he allowed to say, what is he not allowed to say. At this point, the jury is very much honed into what's happening. Of course they would be. It's a commotion. It's exciting. And, you know, the court actually follows up with Isaac again about, you know, clarifying the state's question. And Isaac attempts to respond, but they jump on him again. So now the jury really knows that something important is going on. Whatever Isaac seems to know about Mr. DeBrow is very important and concerning Isaac. And then the circuit court turns to the jury to deliver this instruction, which I have in front of me here, and it says, all right, and to the extent that as the state was raising in an interjection, the answer beyond what he gave just now, I'll direct the jury to strike anything else that they heard beyond the witness's statements that he heard from his mother, but not the content of anything. This whole commotion around Isaac's testimony is what made everything prejudicial. It wasn't just a statement about CCAP. It was the context of the whole case, the fiasco surrounding the testimony that made this prejudicial, and then the circuit court's spontaneous instruction, which didn't instruct the jury to do anything. It said to strike some statements, maybe about what they heard, what Isaac heard from his mother, but not the content of anything. Not as only is that logically impossible for a juror to do, but it's also not a legal truth either. You cannot strike testimony without striking the content of that testimony. So having no idea what this instruction means, The jury is sent home after a whole hullabaloo about what Isaac knew, and they heard that Isaac knew something on CCAP, and the context of the case is that Isaac was concerned about Mr. DeBrow being in his sister's room after testimony that his sister just gave about sexual misconduct. And the reasonable inference, and again, the Court of Appeals does meticulously lay out why this prejudicial is so, this testimony is so prejudicial. The reasonable inference there is that Mr. DeBrow had a record regarding sexual misconduct involving a child. And so that is the prejudicial nature of the testimony. That's why it was unreasonable for the circuit court to conclude otherwise. And then it was also unreasonable for the circuit court to conclude that that instruction cured anything. And I'm not saying that character evidence can't be cured. Of course, I'm not here to say that. But what I am here is that the character evidence that was given to the jury here wasn't cured. And the state attempts to muddy the waters here by saying that Mr. DeBrow didn't offer a jury instruction at the end of those final jury instructions, and therefore he forfeits any argument that, this couldn't be cured, that he had this obligation to cure the error that the state did. But the defense, or really the moving party for the mistrial, does not have a legal requirement to cure the non-moving party's error. And if the requirement, if this case comes out that there is this requirement that the moving party needs to engage in the curative instructions that might be given during trial, then what will happen is that it will either further contribute, a defense attorney can make a strategic decision not to further contribute to already unfair prejudice against their client, or it will completely undermine, if not waive, a defendant's mistrial motion, because the entire basis of that mistrial motion, especially in this case, is that the only appropriate remedy is a mistrial. So if Mr. DeBrow had offered a curative instruction at the end of the trial, we would be here arguing whether or not Mr. DeBrow forfeited the argument that the prejudicial testimony wasn't cured.
Aren't those two I don't know that I see that. Aren't those two separate things? Can't a defense attorney say, I do not believe this, there's any instruction that could cure it, I am reserving my objection, and then offering a curative instruction on the chance that the court is not going to, once the court denies the mistrial, realizing that you might be able to actually cure it? And I mean, other than just trying your luck and rolling the dice and trying to have a mistrial, I don't know how else.
I mean, Mr. DeBrow was not just rolling the dice here in an attempt to get a mistrial, to get a, as the state put it, a second kick at the cat here. Like, I hear that.
And I'm not, I think that came out wrong when I said it. My point is, I think it's very different when you're preserving something like a curative instruction, because you haven't, if you do make the motion for it, you have the opportunity to have a say in what that looks like. And if you don't make the motion for it, and the judge gives one, how do you then complain about what they said? I mean, that's the crux of that issue, because maybe the judge would have said exactly what you wanted them to say.
Sure, but in this case, the court didn't consult with the parties before giving the instruction.
Well, they said something immediately, but then offered to then say something else. So what?
Sure, so the immediate instruction can be reviewed for whether or not it was erroneous exercise of discretion to conclude that that instruction was curative. And then the fact that Mr. DeBrow didn't offer an alternative instruction, which he is not obligated to do, does not, it maintains his motion for a mistrial argument that nothing could cure this. And if he had offered a curative instruction that would have cured this error, or the state would have argued would have cured this error, then Mr. DeBrow would be forfeiting his mistrial or waiving his mistrial argument or making it at the very least.
I don't know that you can forfeit the mistrial argument the same way you can forfeit
the purpose of his mistrial motion was that no curative instruction could be given. This whole fiasco happened. It's too prejudicial. We need a new trial. But also, here is something that could help you, Circuit Court, cure this error.
Once the mistrial is denied. I'm not saying he has to do that, but isn't that an option?
It could be an option in some cases. It wasn't an option here, and it doesn't change the fact that the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion when it denied the mistrial in that moment.
And I hear that, yes. That's preserved and argued here.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, a reviewing court will reverse the denial of a mistrial on a clear showing of erroneous exercise of discretion. That is the issue that we're faced with here. Did the conclusions that the circuit court come to about the prejudicial nature of the testimony and its curative effect of that spontaneous jury instruction actually, were they reasonable? Did it actually cure any error? And was it erroneous for the circuit court to deny the motion for a mistrial on that basis? The Court of Appeals found that it was, using a very straightforward erroneous exercise of discretion analysis, and this court should too. Again, Isaac's testimony does not exist in a vacuum. It was not a fleeting moment. This was a fiasco that the jury was honed in on from the beginning. It could not have been cured, it was not cured, and it resulted in an unfair trial with a tainted jury. The circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion in denying the motion for a mistrial because it came to unreasonable conclusions after failing to consider all the relevant facts and law. And that's why this court should also find that the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion. Unless there are any other questions, I'm happy to sit.
All right, thank you.
I want to begin just to clarify a point that I thought I heard during Ms. Linus's argument, which was I thought I heard her say, and I don't, if I apologize if I'm mistaken about this, but I thought I heard her say that the state's intent in its redirect examination of Isaac was to bring out Mr. DeBrow's prior conviction. As I said in my initial presentation, that's not the case. I don't think the record supports that. I think the record supports that what the prosecutor was trying to get out of Isaac was the prior incidents, the other acts evidence that were admitted and that the Court of Appeals did find were correctly admitted in this trial. So I don't think that's correct, if I heard that correctly. With respect to everything else, we're kind of talking a lot about the instruction that the circuit court gave here. And I think the sort of critical disconnect in what the Court of Appeals did and what Mr. DeBrow's argument is now is that it disregards the fact that the circuit court's decision to deny the mistrial was based both on, yes, it gave an instruction, but also that it was open to giving further instruction. And we talked, there was a lot of discussion about the context of the case. And so the entire context of this mistrial decision involves that offer of further instruction that was turned down.
But how can they meaningfully, the defendant meaningfully offer an instruction, an additional instruction, without undermining the motion for mistrial? The motion for mistrial is based on, this is so prejudicial, it can't be cured. So how can you fault them for failing to ask for additional curative instruction? Are they supposed to raise the very thing that is so damaging to them? Is the instruction supposed to say, the witness testified that he looked at CCAP, and as many of you know, CCAP contains information about prior criminal criminal convictions? What is he supposed to offer?
Sure.
It seems like the idea of offering anything undermines his mistrial motion and therefore is not a legitimate argument.
Well, a couple points. First of all, I would say that the state is often in the somewhat awkward position of arguing things in the alternative. So you will frequently see briefs from this state that say there was no evidentiary error here. But if there was, it was harmless, right? And the state makes those arguments on appeal all the time. And so the idea that the defense cannot be tasked with arguing in the alternative and saying there is no instruction that could be given here But since you've denied my motion for a mistrial, at the very least, you have to, as Pentagar, as they're, you know, pointing to Pentagar, you have to identify the testimony to be stricken and what we mean by striking. On that point, I would note the circuit court did issue the pattern jury instruction on stricken testimony at closing jury instructions at the request of the defense. It said, disregard all stricken testimony. It's a very straightforward instruction. That's the pattern instruction, and I think it's clear about what it means. And this was the only stricken testimony throughout the entire trial. So as far as identifying it, all of that. To your point, though, about what instruction could be offered, I mean, I think that kind of comes into this idea that no instruction could have been enough because any instruction was the cure was going to be worse than the disease. And, you know, this isn't a situation where the circuit court's initial instruction right out of the gate before consulting with the parties was you're to disregard the fact that the defendant has previously been convicted of first-degree sexual assault of a child. The circuit court didn't bring that up, but I think what we have here and what the record shows is that the circuit court was a little reluctant to draw more attention to this and therefore offered that choice to the defense. And I think that's an appropriate action for the circuit court to take. They said, look, we're in one of two situations here. Either the jury heard this, in which case I'm happy to give you more instruction that they should disregard it, or they didn't and we don't want to bring more attention to it, in which case I'm happy to just let it go and we move on. But that's the appropriate exercise of discretion that we entrust to the circuit court. And so I don't think it follows that simply because a curative instruction may have involved pointing out the error more, you know, I think when you have a close case, you have to offer more deference to the circuit court's decision, not less. And so if it's a close call on do we want to draw more attention to this or do we want to let it go, I think deferring to the circuit court and deferring to the circuit court's deference to the defense, so to speak, is the appropriate action for the circuit court to take there. I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you very much. Interesting oral argument. We are now adjourned. We'll reconvene for the third oral argument at 1:30.